Today on Maine Calling, bugs that do good. Bugs rule the world. There are more than 1.5 million species of insects. They've been around for at least 480 million years. They are essential to the food chain, to all other life. Despite this, bugs get a lot of shade. We complain about beetles on our roses, grubs in our lawns, and spiders in the bathroom. Giant insects are the stuff of horror movies. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we flip the conversation about bugs. We'll learn about all the beneficial insects in our ecosystem and what we can do to protect them. After all, insects are disappearing at an alarming rate. It's estimated that the world has lost 5 to 10% of all insect species in the last 150 years. Beneficial bugs on Maine Calling. That's just ahead.
Maine Calling on Demand is made possible by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to island and coastal Downeys communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Most people are bothered by bugs, especially ones who cause problems like termites, mosquitoes, and ticks. But then there are the beneficial bugs, most of them really, insects, spiders, and other creatures that help us in so many ways. We are going to talk about good bugs today. Joining me, Allison Canody, who is forest entomologist with the Maine Forest Service, Hillary Peterson, integrated pest management entomologist with the Maine Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry, and Gary Fish, our state horticulturist. He is also with the Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. We invite you to join the conversation. Do you wonder how to identify certain bugs, how to tell if they are beneficial or not so much in your garden? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to all of you. Welcome back to all of you onto Maine Calling. Allison, I'll start with you. And very briefly, we're going to talk about not beneficial bugs. We're going to set the stage by talking about the harmful ones, those bugs that have been in the headlines in Maine in the last few years. Give us some examples of the most problematic insects in Maine and the status of our fight against them.
Great. Thanks so much, Jennifer. So I did want to start out kind of with a bit of good news about bad bugs, and that's that so far in Maine, Asian longhorn beetle has not been found in our forests. And a reason I highlight that is that August is tree check month. And the reason for that is we encourage people to get out and look at their trees for these invasive pests, because the public is really important in our battle against these insects. So some of the not so great news is that so far in Maine, emerald ash borer has been found in 7 of our 16 counties. Brown-tailed moth, a bit of good news is we did have some population control from diseases this past spring. And so it looks like the impacted area is going to be much lower than in the previous years. We should be able to start seeing feeding damage from the late summer larvae really soon. And sort of news on piercing and sucking insects. Hemlock woolly adelgid, we haven't seen really significant inroads this year into our state for that pest. It has a slow, inexorable spread across the area that's susceptible to it. And we have seen some real expansion and damage from red pine scale in Downeast Maine. That's kind of a brief overview of some of the invaders in our state and how they're behaving.
All right. So let me circle back to something you said. August is tree check month. I didn't know, but now our audience knows. How do you advise someone to check their tree? What would you like people to be doing right now?
So spending some time when you're out in your yard or out on a walk, taking a look for the signs of invasive insects or diseases. And so there's a variety of resources available online to help people figure out what those signs and symptoms are. But a lot of times it's looking at the stem of the tree or the leaves for signs of damage. And particularly in those areas where you're frequenting, just taking a little bit of extra time to take a look at those trees.
All right. And some resources might be, does the Maine Forest Service have a page?
The Maine Forest Service does have an invasive pest page. It's maine.gov/forestpests.
Great. Okay. So now we're going to talk about, for the rest of the hour, what we came to talk about, which is beneficial bugs. Gary, I'm going to start with you. I understand that most of the 150 million species of insects are considered good. Why? Why are they beneficial?
Multiple reasons. Yeah, really only maybe about 4 or 5% of insects or organisms are pests, and all the rest are not. And they can be everything from food for other animals or pollinators, or they could be parasites of pests. So things like even big wasps and small wasps can either eat some of the pests that we have out there, or they lay their eggs on those pests and kill them that way. And we have lots of insects that provide us with food. We also have insects that provide us with the kind of what we call ecosystem services that are needed to keep your whole food chain running. So there's lots of different reasons why they're beneficial.
Ecosystem services, they take care of things that are dead and dying. Is that what you mean
yes,
by that?
That's part of it for sure. So if we didn't have lots of different organisms that are breaking down things, then we'd be knee deep in you know what.
All right, Hillary, what do you want to add to that? What do you want to add to Gary's start of talking about why bugs are so beneficial?
Sure. Yeah. Just a couple other points, you know, some more ecosystem services include things like pollination. I think that's definitely a hot topic, and people think of bees when they think of pollinators, but there are moths and there are flies that also pollinate lots of other insects too. When it comes to the decomposition, that is helpful for our soil health. And one interesting example I read in a UMaine Extension article is that dung beetles are really important for providing ecosystem services in our wild blueberry fields because they move things away from the blueberries. So that reduces the chance of us getting illness from you know, what they move. And, you know, one point I just always like to make when we're talking about beneficial insects and quote unquote bad insects is that this is all the perspective of us as humans. And we're kind of making these terms. You know, there are habitats and all these insects have evolved over millions of years to live in those habitats. And then we move on in. And depending on if they help or hurt us, we view them as good or bad. And we'll get into this more. But oftentimes, many of the beneficial insects look a whole lot like the harmful ones, to the point that I've had email threads pulling in 5 or 6 different specialists to figure out, is it this one or that one? So it can get really tough in the identification of these things sometimes.
All right, Allison, add to that. What about the forest? What is the role of beneficial insects in the forest environment?
So a lot of the same things that both Hillary and Gary mentioned. So I'll highlight the parasitoids, so insects that oftentimes insects that attack other insects and cause them to die, keeping what we consider pest species in a balance with the natural world, predators as well, providing similar services, decomposers. You think about dead and dying trees are an important part of our forest ecosystems. And the insects that help to break them down are really important in taking that material that's not super nutritious for other organisms and breaking it down into soil eventually, really. So it's those types of roles that they play in the forest systems and in ways that a lot of times we don't expect and we're still learning about.
Still learning about. Gary, usually when you're on Maine Calling, it's to talk about gardening. let's face it, people don't like to see bugs in their gardens. They don't like to see moths in their broccoli. They don't like to see Japanese beetles on their rose bushes. Help us reframe how we ought to be thinking about our garden, how we ought to be looking at insects in our garden, how you look at insects in your garden.
So I think first and foremost is that people need to be careful and look carefully at what they're observing and thinking it might be a pest and making sure that they identify it before they scapegoat it. So you can use resources. The Maine Integrated Pest Management Council has a resource called gutpests.org. And there's a whole section on both pest insects and diseases and things like that, as well as on beneficial organisms. And they can go there to look to try to identify something, or there are many resources they can go to get ID of particular problems, or maybe they're beneficial. Everything from us at the Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry, but Cooperative Extension, and also the disease and plant pest diagnostic lab that they have at the University of Maine that not only does ticks and things like that, but also can ID other insects and pathogens that might be on their garden plants. So for me, it's really, I'm thinking that when I see something like that, I'm thinking that it's probably going to be good, because the majority of what you're going to see is probably going to be good. And until I know exactly what I'm looking at, I'm not going to take any actions once I find out whether it's beneficial or not. You know, for instance, with the Japanese beetle, if it has little white dots on its back, it's had a winsome fly lay its eggs on its back. So that would be one that, even though that is a pest, you know, I'm looking at a Japanese beetle, that's a pest, but it has a beneficial already on it that's going to kill it. So I don't want to pick that one off. I want to leave it there and let it, you know, run its cycle so that it will dig itself down in the ground and the winsome flies will, you know, basically eat it from the inside out, and then they'll pupate in the soil and come out as an adult fly in the late, mid, early summer. And, you know, that's the way I kind of look at things.
Hillary, a lot of people who don't want to use pesticides will try to release some sort of insects into their garden for pest management. You know, all you have to do is go on the internet and all sorts of recommendations for what you can release to control this or control that. Tell us sort of briefly, are there any greatest hits that work and are pretty tried and true? And are there others that you would warn people against? Yeah, don't do that. That's not a good idea.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's a really important discussion to have, especially, as you said, how easy it is to buy things online these days. And actually, when it comes to doing biocontrol at home, I sort of broadly advise against it. So the Maine Inland Fisheries and Wildlife actually has a list, a wildlife importation permit list that is basically maintained, that has all of the things that you can release. It's called the unrestricted species list. And I don't think that many things that you could find online actually are allowed to be purchased and released. And the reason behind that is this is a really tough thing to regulate. You know, someone might buy something online thinking they're getting one species and they actually get another, and it could turn out to be something we don't have here in Maine. And so that could really disrupt the balance of the ecosystem that we have here. Now, what I would suggest people do in sort of terms of biological control in their gardens is, instead of releasing an organism, there's another type of biocontrol called conservation biocontrol. And this is something that everybody can participate in. And broadly, the idea is to create a happy habitat for the predators and parasitoids that are already in your yard and in your garden, or even you could attract them to your yard and garden to kind of help take care of some of those garden pests for those. So, you know, as Gary said before, one important thing would be to know what the beneficials are. So when you see them, you don't just kind of blanket kill everything you see. And on top of that, there's a lot of work that shows that, especially for parasitoids, which are, I tend to say, about sesame seed-sized cousins of wasps. These little parasitoids, as adults, do feed on nectar. So many of the same pollinator garden resources you might find, those same flowers and the recommendations of having them blooming sort of over the course of the summer with native species to here in Maine, can provide nectar resources that will attract parasitoid mothers who will come and feed, and then they'll parasitize the eggs or the caterpillars or the different things that are feeding on your garden. One example that many gardeners have probably seen before is if you've ever seen a tomato hornworm with sort of all these white fuzzy lines kind of coming off of its back, that's been parasitized by a little braconid wasp. There's some really good resources for conservation biocontrol. The Xerces Society has a web page with lots of fact sheets. And we also have some information as well on gutpest.org.
All right, so what I'm going to do after the program is I'm going to ask you all to provide resources, and I'm going to put them in the Maine Calling newsletter. So a good
Great.
reason for anybody who hasn't subscribed yet to subscribe to Maine Calling's weekly newsletter, and also I'll make sure I get all these resources in one place for you all. I'm going to go to Tabitha, who's calling from Kittery. Hi, go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. So my question has to do with sort of the larger picture of insects in Maine. I know that across the world we're seeing a huge die-off and loss of insect species. And so my question is whether or not we've had any good research in Maine about how that's happened. I'm sure I'm only 31, but since my childhood, I've noticed way fewer bugs on my windshield at night and way fewer mosquito bites when I'm out hiking. And I'm just curious if anything, we know about that in Maine.
Tabitha, I'm so glad you brought that up because I've heard that from a lot of people that you don't seem to have the same kind of bugs on your windshield after a road trip that we used to in our childhood. Allison, what about this die-off, the disappearing insects? We know that this is happening worldwide. Is it happening at these great numbers in Maine as well?
So there has been actually, Hillary is president of Maine Entomological Society, and Frank Drummond recently gave a really nice overview of the project that he did, looking at the data that's available in Maine to look at insect declines. So unfortunately, like as scientists, we like to be able to point to really, solid data to answer those types of questions. So I can say, as you mentioned, that yeah, it seems like there's a lot going on as far as insect decline in Maine. But handling or looking at the data that we have available, it's a little bit hard to answer that question from a real solid scientific background. But I think what we can do as people who are dependent on insects in our ecosystems is to do things that help to support their populations. So things like limiting the outdoor lighting that we have around our habitation, limiting the use of pesticides in our environment, and supporting the habitat that supports those insects are all important things that we can do to help support insects in our environment that, as we've talked about, are really quite beneficial to us.
Gary.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that for a lot of us, we grew up in a Maine that wasn't quite as inhabited as it is today. So a lot of habitat has been taken away by building houses and commercial enterprises. And then those houses oftentimes have lots of lights, as Allison noted. And those lights really cause a lot of problems for a lot of insects, either attracting them and basically killing them because they exhaust themselves, or making it so they can't breed or do what they're supposed to do, especially the nighttime insects. And those are the ones that you normally see hitting your windshield. So it's not surprising that we might have reduced some of those populations. But as Allison said, the research is not as robust as it needs to be to really know or understand it. And a lot of that data came, or the original concern about that came from Germany. And I don't know as though we can really compare ourselves to Germany. It's been inhabited with lots more people for a much longer time than the United States has. But it's important to continue to look at this and make sure that we're understanding what is actually going on and trying to reduce those impacts.
Tabitha, thank you so much for the question. If you have a question, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post a comment on Facebook or Instagram. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're learning about the different ways bugs can be beneficial. My guests, all with the Department of Maine, Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. Hillary Peterson and Allison Canody are entomologists, and Gary Fish is our state horticulturist. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, a brief email, please. Comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We have an email here from Dre. If you have a bird bath out, position a longish rock in a way that comes out of the water and past the vessel lip so that any insect that slips into the water while taking sips can find purchase on the rock and carry on. Also, last month I was in a boat at night in northern Maine and could not believe how unbelievably many insects there were when we shined a flashlight over the water towards shore. It was breathtaking. So I'll circle back and I'll ask you, Hillary, do you like Dre's birdbath suggestion?
Yeah, I think that's good. I think there might be some recommendations with birdbaths, at least making sure that the water is fresh frequently so that they don't become mosquito homes. If you don't know, mosquito larvae are aquatic, and any sort of anything as small as a bottle cap in your backyard with water in it can be a perfect home for baby mosquitoes. So yes, as long as you keep that water fresh.
An email from Johnny. I have a feeling this is for you, Gary. Wondering if you could suggest some beneficial plants we might incorporate in our gardens and orchards to invite parasitic wasps that might help with infestations of things like tomato hornworms, Colorado potato beetles, and tent and brown tail moth caterpillars.
Well, many of those insects that are parasites or even some predators, but especially parasites, are feeding on nectar as adults to stay alive. So any plant that's going to produce a fair amount of nectar is good. What I see oftentimes, and right now it's blooming, is goldenrod is a real good plant for a lot of the wasps like to go to that to get some nectar. They might take some protein from the pollen too, but probably they're looking for nectar. I think, you know, basically anything that provides a fair amount of nectar with a lot of flowers on it are probably going to be good. I don't know specifically from research which ones are the best for those types of parasites or parasitoids. I don't know if Allison knows more about that.
Nope. Okay. So Allison, I think this one's going to be for you. An email from Rob. We love our insects in rural Maine. We don't apply pesticides on our garden or yard because we have bats, birds, and other insectivores that eat insects, and we don't want to harm them. Bats can eat a lot of insects every night, and we prefer they not accumulate toxins in their system. So I know none of you are bat specialists, but this is one of the big emerging stories in environmental science recently, is how many bats we've been losing. So Allison, would you agree that bats can be harmed by insects that have been exposed to some sort of chemical?
I guess you'd have to know more about the chemicals being used, because there are varying toxicities to different types of organisms. Like some pesticides have low mammalian toxicity and some pesticides have higher mammalian toxicity. But if you can, you know, target your pest management to limit pesticide use, that's often the best approach. Sometimes there is not a great alternative to using insecticides. And in that case, then using the least toxic pesticide that you can based on the application or the target pest that you are looking at be helpful.
I'll go to Dave, who's calling from North Yarmouth. Hi, Dave. Go ahead.
Hi. I am an avid fly fisherman, and for the past 20 years, anecdotally speaking, I have seen a significant decrease in the amount of insects. I've also seen a decrease in the amount of bats in my area. You know, along the line of what we've been speaking about, I'm concerned that a significant amount of this has to do with pesticide use. And not just that, but chemical use in general. And, you know, what I wanted to call and do was just encourage everybody, you know, when they're using anything or doing anything, when they move to using chemicals, they need to stop and think if this is really, really necessary. People spray so much stuff on their lawns and, you know, on their gardens and in these areas. These aren't just harmful to the insects, but they're also harmful to us. You know, cleaning chemicals, the list goes on and on. But the second you move to a chemical is when we need to stop and think, is this really necessary? And is there an alternative?
Dave, thanks for your call. Gary.
I don't disagree with that at all. I think that we should minimize our reliance on pesticides as much as possible. And I think that using them for aesthetic purposes is not always that justifiable. I think there are a lot of very justifiable uses of pesticides, and I think we have to be careful about how we characterize that. And, you know, using the term chemical, everything is a chemical. So even if you're going to use something that's natural, it's still a chemical. It can still have the same kinds of risks and maybe same kinds of benefits as using what we would call a conventional pesticide. So I think it's really important for people to not get too excited about the difference between conventional and natural and all of those things. And what's really important is to, first of all, know if it's a pest, then know if you have enough of a pest to do anything about it, and then choose something that you know is going to work. Because if you choose something that's never been tested on that particular pest and you use it, it's a waste of chemical, it's a waste of time, it potentially causes non-target damage. So it's really important to do the homework and then choose the thing that is the most on target, the most pinpoint, and it's going to actually work. And then if you can avoid it, then, you know, avoid it. Oftentimes, if there's a pest there, it may not ever reach a level of damage that's going to hurt you or hurt the plant or something like that. So I think it's not black and white.
Hillary?
Jumping right off that, you know, when it comes to people having their lawns treated for ticks and mosquitoes, I just want to urge folks to learn that there are other things that you can do to protect yourself in addition. And again, this is case by case. Sometimes it just might be necessary depending on the scenario, but you know, there are other things you can do. I always push personal protective equipment. One of my favorite things is to wear long pants, hiking socks up over those pants. And then there's these awesome things, Limeez, L-Y-M-E-E-Z, or there's other probably off-brand. They're called tick gaiters. And so they're a Velcro like rectangle that you put around your ankle, and they come pre-treated with permethrin, and they're kind of a mesh. So when ticks get on permethrin, the tick feels like it's on fire. So they basically drop right off. So this is just a great protective measure. It's not a silver bullet, but you can really reduce the amount of ticks and getting home and doing tick checks. And there's lots of great resources for learning how to make tick-free zones in your yard too. Again, nothing is perfect, but each of these measures kind of compiled on top of each other can really protect you. And one final point I have to make on all this is if you do have your lawn treated, it doesn't mean that everything's gone. You still need to, you might have a false sense of safety. You still need to do tick checks, and those sprays do also sometimes kill beneficial. So it's just a, you know, part of a risk benefit analysis you kind of need to make for your own life.
An email here from Bruce. I just heard about that Rhode Island dragonfly swarm and thought it was pretty cool. We love our dragonflies cruising above our deck, eating skeeters and looking like miniature flight of B-17s. Last evening before the rain, I was sitting there head tipped back and saw within the area of open sky, probably no fewer than 40 at a time, never got a skeeter bite. We've also made a concerted effort to plant new gardens to support pollinators. This has expanded our, he uses this in quotes, flock of butterflies and has brought in a lot more honeybees. So I'd love to go back to the beginning of Bruce's email and talk about dragonflies. A lot of people, I think, in conversations have been talking about seeing more dragonflies. And let's talk about, they're not just beautiful, Allison, but they really do. They eat mosquitoes, and they're an important part of the ecosystem.
Yeah, one of my favorite publications from the government from the spruce budworm outbreak, the last big spruce budworm outbreak, was actually a full list of, well, probably not full, but a pretty extensive list of the predators of spruce budworm in Maine. And it has wonderful color illustrations, including illustrations of dragonflies attacking the adult moths of the spruce budworm in forest settings. So yeah, dragonflies are really important predators, both in the air and under the water as well. And you know, it's another one that folks often look at as, you know, if some dragonflies are good, then bringing in more is even better. And that's another one where we discourage that practice because it can threaten the systems that you bring them into, because sometimes they are not the same species as are advertised. And another thing that folks don't think about maybe as much is it can actually alter sort of the genetic population of that insect in Maine if you're bringing them from other areas of the country.
So if you don't, Allison, if you don't want to be bringing in, you don't want to be mail ordering dragonflies, but you'd like to have more, is there anything else you might suggest?
It's always looking at habitat when you're trying to bring in more of a predator or parasitoid or something like that. It's looking at what are their habitat needs, and are there ways that you can help to support their habitat.
So other than living by a lake, what would you recommend you do to support their habitat?
I'm really not sure.
You could put in a pond.
Okay, we'll go to Franny, who's calling from Stockton Springs. Hi, Franny, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to mention Mothka as a good resource, especially if you want to use less pesticides, less chemicals. They're a good resource. We had some problems we weren't able to identify ourselves in our orchard, and they quickly told us, oh, that's this, and you can put these bags out and you'll identify what you've got. They've been very, very helpful for us as a small organic farm here in Maine.
Franny, thanks so much for calling and letting us know. I appreciate it. We'll move up to Bob in Montville. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. My approach is just to leave it alone. I don't discriminate. I don't think there's good weeds, good bugs, bad bugs. They're all here. Every single plant that I have that people hate has bugs in it, but every bee that you can imagine. So I just advocate for that. I mow once in the fall and then let it come up as a jungle in the spring. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling in, Gary. And, you know, so much discussion our last gardening show, we talked about this a lot, about how often to mow. And now the thinking of having no mow May, I understand, is not the current thinking, but mow less often. Pick up on that. How is mowing our property or not mowing our property affecting our insect population?
Well, it really depends upon what plant you have there. And, you know, there are some invasive plants that, yes, they do attract insects, and you're going to see pollinators on them, and they're, you know, going to have various different wildlife using them. But in general, it's our native plants that our native insects have learn to use as habitat, as food, as cover, as whatever they might need. And that's why, you know, we say that there are some plants that are invasive, because they are very aggressive, they take over an area, and they don't provide, again, all the ecosystem services that our native plants do. And so I don't necessarily disagree with that caller. You know, I had a 2-acre field that I would only have mown once every 2 years, very late in the fall. It had lots of native plants, but it also had some non-native plants, some of which were invasive, and yes, had lots of pollinators and lots of garden spiders and the whole panoply of different types of beneficials that might have been there. But in reality, if we can find a way to reestablish those native plants and those native insects, then we are going to then provide the food in the food chain that's supposed to be there, that all the other native animals have learned to utilize. And I think that that's something that is a goal, but in many situations, it's not achievable. It's just not something that people are going to be able to do. So as I mentioned before, you know, if you want to attract beneficial insects, both predators, parasites, pollinators, probably the best thing you can do is have continuous blooming of plants in your yard. So if you have continuous blooms, then you're going to attract a lot of those. And then the other thing to think about are, do you have the host plants that those insects depend upon in their larval stage? So it's usually the adult stage that's using the pollen and nectar, but the larval stage, you know, like the monarch butterfly caterpillar, it needs to have the right kind of milkweed there and not have the invasive plant that Hillary knows a lot about, which is black swallowwort.
Yeah, well, thank you for that call. And I was just thinking, you know, one of the most popular programs we do every year, a couple times a year, is our bird watching program. And the more beneficial insects you have, Hillary, the more birds you're going to have in your yard.
Yes, there is a number. Maybe Gary knows it. There's a number of caterpillars one baby bird needs. Do you know it, Gary?
Well, there's a study that was done on the chickadees in the Washington, D.C. area. And it's like 4,000 caterpillars to raise a chick up to the fledgling stage.
Yeah, wow. Exactly. And so, you know, one thing to think about is we want to have some plants in our yard where we do see some caterpillar damage. And everything isn't just black and white. There's sort of a gray area, and you can have trees that have leaves that have been chewed on by caterpillars. And as long as the ecosystem is balanced and it's not an invasive species like the winter moth that just completely defoliates a tree, trees have defenses and trees are able to survive a certain amount of damage. And so you need to have plants there to feed the insects like the caterpillars, to feed the birds, so we can have our chickadees and things like that.
Allison.
Yeah, I think sometimes reframing what we think as a pest and thinking about, you know, are there roles that they play that we think are beneficial? So an example would be eastern tent caterpillar, which people will see in cherries and service berries and apples and other fruit trees in the spring. And a lot of times the question is, how do I get rid of this? And a better question might be, you know, do I need to get rid of this? I always advocate, if it's not harming something that you're going to be using for fruit or is really important as an aesthetic in your landscape, then leave it alone. If it is harming something that falls into those categories, even moving the web so that they can establish on another tree in your yard can be a way to support them and have them support things like predators and parasitoids that might actually help you with some of your other pests.
And Gary, you have an update on the chickadee stat.
Yeah, so I want to correct that. So it's 6,000 to 9,000 to rear a clutch of Carolina chickadees, and their average clutch size is 6. So you're talking about 1,000 to 1,500 caterpillars to raise a single chick.
Hardworking chickadee parents, that's for sure. We are talking about beneficial insects on Maine Calling. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are talking about bugs, but not the problem with them, how they are beneficial. We have three experts here from the Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry, horticulturist Gary Fish, and entomologist Hillary Peterson and Allison Canody. If you're quick, you can join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. I'm going to go to this email from Scott. Which plant or insect ID apps do your guests recommend? I use Merlin from Cornell for bird ID. It's amazing and so much fun. These apps are so fun. Okay, Hillary, what would you recommend?
Sure. So I'm very passionate about this. So, you know, when someone sends me an insect ID and I'm not sure what it is, I sort of take a multi-step process. There's really not like one perfect app. Nowadays, even there are I think on iPhones, you can take a picture of an insect and there's a little button you can click. And I would always say it's just like if you were using a GPS to get to some back road northern Maine place, you're going to use that to get you close, but you need to know it might not be 100% accurate. So, you know, say you have a caterpillar and maybe you've gone on Google and you looked up orange black caterpillar mane and you find a picture that looks kind of like it, there are two websites that I really like to use. One is called bugguide.net and the other is called iNaturalist. And so if you think it's something, I would then take the name of that species that you came up with and then look on one of those websites, because those have verified photos by experts. And so one of my favorite things to do is to, if I think I have a species, if I think I know what it is, going on to iNaturalist, you can filter by the state of Maine. And so that way you have verified IDs of things that are actually here in Maine. So I hope that makes sense to listeners that, you know, it's sort of a multi-step approach to ID things. If you want to have something that's not digital, I think that it has nothing to do with my last name. The Peterson Field Guide for Insects is a great place to start. And then again, we have websites like gotpest.org that have some of the more common groups of insects here in Maine that are, you know, filtered right down for you.
An email from Peg, late spring or early summer, I was thrilled to see so many lightning bugs. Where did they go? I was also thrilled. So many more fireflies this year, that seemed, at least in my yard. Which of you wants to talk about the life cycle of fireflies, lightning bugs? Gary, have you seen many of them up in your area?
So I've been living at my camp on Flying Pond, and I've seen tons of lightning bugs or fireflies or whatever you want to call them. You know, their life cycle is they live in the ground to begin with. They spend most of their years there, and then they'll emerge as adults. And the male and female need to be able to find each other. And if you have bright lights, they can't find each other. And that's probably the main reason why we have seen less and less of these insects, because they can't mate. And if they can't mate, then there's not going to be any new ones. So one of the things that I've done at my place is I've done away with all of the white lights and all the bright lights. And now I have red lights. And there is some recent research that shows that if you use LED red lights, they're less likely to confuse the lightning bugs, fireflies, whatever you want to call them. Hopefully that's real. It's only one study, but I think it's a lot better than having other very bright lights. I even keep my lights off inside as much as I can so that they're not shining out through the windows. And, you know, they're very interesting insects. The female will court their male and bring them in and then probably kill the male. But it's, they're fewer of them because we have too many lights.
We'll go to Maggie calling from York. Hi, Maggie. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We haven't discussed spiders yet. And about 10 years ago, I had this infestation of these big black spiders with yellow striped legs. And I got bitten on one and had to go to the emergency room. My foot, like, doubled in size. And I know spiders are beneficial. And I just wanted comments on what are the bad ones to get rid of. And when I had this infestation of these, and they were everywhere, all over my house. And I live by the ocean, and, you know, I wanted to get rid of them, and I'm too afraid of them because when they bit me. But I know they're good things. Any just comments about spiders?
Okay. Who do we want to have? Hillary, are you want to talk about spiders? And how do you know, like, I mean, we live in Maine. We get spiders in our house. How do we know that this is an infestation we need to get rid of versus just catch it with a tissue and set it free?
Sure. First of all, term-wise, infestation, technically, when you're talking about pest management in a structure, would be when a bunch of organisms live somewhere and they're able to mate and reproduce. You know, you might think of like cockroaches. So I'm not sure that we really ever have large infestations of spiders. I guess the best approach in my head might just be to be wary to not get bitten. And if you want to move something, to just, you know, put some gloves on and maybe use a jar and release it away from your house. Spider-wise, if folks don't know, a few years ago, the Maine Forest Service, September 2020, published a checklist of Maine spiders. That you can find that free online. You can either search it. I think it's on the Forest Health website. And It's a giant list that's all of the spiders in Maine with information about them. So if spiders are something you find interesting, you can learn there, or you can look spiders up again on iNaturalist and filter by Maine. And, you know, spiders, they are important. And I love that the caller knew that and talked about that. They're predators. You know, they tend to be generalist predators, meaning that they'll eat lots of different insects, and they can really reduce prey. They can reduce some of the insects that might be in your home. You know, if I have one little spider in the corner, I think it's my fly catcher friend. And so, yeah. Gary, did you have any, or Allison, anything you wanted to add to that?
Sure. So, you know, I think spiders are kind of like wasps. You know, if you fool around with them, you're liable to get bitten. Or if you just happen to step on one or be close to one accidentally, then you might get stung or bitten. And, you know, unless you're around like a yellow jacket nest where they're going to protect their nest, generally they're going to be good because they are predators too. They're out there looking for all different types of insects, including some of the things that cause problems for our trees and our vegetables and things like that. We don't really have the brown recluse spiders and the, you know, widow spiders, black widow spiders, that they do come in once in a while on imported vegetation and vegetables and things like that. But generally we don't have populations of them. So it's not like we have these really poisonous spiders, although all of them, if you do get bitten by the rare spider that can bite you, because most of them are too small, they can't really bite you anyways. And if you do, then you are liable to have a reaction to it. Some people have real bad skin reactions, or, you know, like she said, maybe your hand or your foot starts to swell. But even the, you know, beautiful garden spiders that are out there, as long as you don't go try to grab them, they're just a wonderful thing to look at and observe, and they're really catching a lot of potential pests for us. So they're pretty good.
Yeah, and Carla on Facebook put a picture of, put a photograph, and she write, "I'm grateful to the spider that got this big boy, a massive horsefly dangling from underneath a mailbox." So I wouldn't want a massive horsefly on my mailbox either. So the spider took care of that for her. Rob says in an email, "Please ask your guests about places to purchase flowering plants that are free from neonicotinoids, which are harmful to bees and other pollinators." Gary, aren't all flowering plants in Maine today free of these?
I don't think we can say that 100%. I doubt that there's a whole lot of operations that are using neonicotinoids on plants that they're growing in Maine. I think that they're still being used on very small plants when they're first starting out. And many of the plants that are eventually sold in Maine or grown outside of Maine, their initial small stages are grown in other parts of the country or even outside of the United States. So there's no way to say that they are 100% free. There may be growers that advertise that they're, you know, not using them. If they are used when the plants are really young, it's unlikely that the doses that would be still present in those plants and those flowers are going to be toxic enough to cause problems for beneficial insects or pollinators. If they're used later on, or if a person applies it to their plants when they're in flower, that's the highest risk of all, where there's going to be potential problems. There are some neonics that aren't very toxic to beneficials, and there are other neonics that are very toxic to beneficials. So just saying neonics in general is probably not the best thing to, you know, think about. And as with any pesticide that you're using, you need to read and follow the label directions. And some of the labels will have warnings about pollinators, and some may not.
We'll go to Mike, who's calling from Tennant's Harbor. Mike, we're tight on time, so if you could be quick, that'd be great.
I will be quick. Always a pleasure, Jennifer. I was out to bid a job one day, and it was a sandy area, and I saw this huge swarm of insects. I got a little bit closer, and it was a huge swarm of dragonflies, and they're diving and flying off and everything, and I couldn't figure out what they were doing real close. And there was a hatch of ants, and as the ants left the ground and started to fly, the dragonflies were just snagging them, taking them out and eating them. So that was just one of the coolest things I ever saw. And I thought that maybe something like that may explain what was going on in Rhode Island. If there was a hatching of insects that they like, that could have been why they swarmed that beach.
Thanks so much, Mike. What a fun, it sounds like a nature documentary you got to witness. Unfortunately, Allison, I'll let you wrap up real quick.
I was just saying his story, it reminds me of one of the key benefits of insects, and that's that it ignites our curiosity about the natural world.
Well, that's going to be our last word today. Thank you, Mike, and thank you to our guests, Allison Canody, forest entomologist, Hillary Peterson, integrated pest management entomologist, and Gary Fish, state horticulturist, all with the Maine Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. Today's sound engineer was Jane Donahue, and Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I mentioned our newsletter earlier. Sign up for that. It's free at mainecalling.org. You can also download the Maine Public Vox Pop app to easily send us voice messages. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.